This series of lectures on C.G. Jung and the tradition of Gnosis was delivered at the C.G. Jung Institute, Zurich, on February 4th, 5th, and 6th of 2013. The lectures are given by Dr. Lance Owens. This third and final lecture in the series is titled The Prophet's Bride. Around 1911, a mysterious feminine power made Dr. Jung's acquaintance. She became a major force in his life over the next decades. Their relationship became perhaps the most important event in Dr. Jung's life. But up to the present, the facts of it all have really received very little discussion. And caution was due, because the documentation was missing. Liber Novus has changed that situation. Now, with a record in hand, we meet a new task. If we're going to understand the whole of Dr. Jung, we must examine the facts of this occult affair in full context. Jung first mentions the woman's name in a letter to Sigmund Freud. From the wording of the letter, which is dated 29 August 1911, it appears young Dr. Jung already had some very strong intuitions about her. Jung suggested she had something to offer both of them, Jung and Freud. Of course, Dr. Freud wanted nothing to do with it. In Dr. Freud's analysis, she was a shady lady with mud on her skirts. Eventually, Dr. Jung's continuing and developing relationship with this enigmatic figure drove the two men apart forever. Let me read that revelatory letter from Dr. Jung to Dr. Freud, a part of the historical record, once again dated 29 August 1911. This is Jung writing. "I have the feeling that this is a time full of marvels. And if the auguries do not deceive us, it may very well be that we are on the threshold of something really sensational, which I scarcely know how to describe except with the Gnostic concept of Sophia. An Alexandrian term particularly suited to the reincarnation of ancient wisdom in the shape of Psi Alpha." End quote. The lady whom Jung was courting was called Sophia, Lady of Wisdom, Sapientia. And she had quite a reputation in some circles, reaching back over 2,000 years. At the time, Dr. Jung knew scarcely how to describe her, except as an Alexandrian Gnostic concept. But then, he did not yet know her very well. That would change. Over coming years, C.G. Jung's occult affair with Sophia played a crucial role in his life and in his works. So I said Dame Sophia, Lady Sophia, had quite a reputation. In fact, the gossip about her started about an eon ago, an eon before Jung made her acquaintance. Rumor of her started circulating back in the 3rd or 4th century B.C., the period Jung identified as the cusp of the Aeon of Pisces, the beginning of the Christian age. We find Sophia named in Proverbs and in the book of Job. And in Ecclesiasticus, a little bit later, also known as the Wisdom of Ben Sira. Sophia is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word chokmah, which means wisdom. In her story's earliest rendition in Proverbs, she was a, quote, female figure playing always before Yahweh, after having been created by him at the beginning. The Wisdom of Ben Sira, or Ecclesiasticus, which dates in its authorship probably about 180 years B.C., moves the story forward and describes Sophia as having been created from the very beginning and as having been infused into all of God's works. She is described as traversing the entire cosmos. Philo of Alexandria and the author, the unknown author of the Wisdom of Solomon, wrote about her in the middle Platonic voice of the early first century in Alexandria. And they said to know her was a rapture. The Wisdom of Solomon describes the event of meeting her with frank sexual imagery. She is the bride with whom one entered the bridal chamber. Union with her is union with God. David Winston, who is the editor of the Anchor Bible Commentary on the Wisdom of Solomon, an authoritative work, states, "There appears to be good reason to conclude that the author's highly charged language concerning the pursuit of Sophia of wisdom and her promised gifts may allude to a mystical experience. Through which, he believes, man is capable of some measure of union with deity, at least under the aspect of Sophia." End quote. A mystical experience leading to union with deity, or to union with Sophia's aspect of deity. And there you have them again, those diffuse words. Mystical experience. What was that experience? Sophia alone could reveal herself. And indeed she did, as affirmed by the Wisdom of Solomon. Let me read from the Wisdom of Solomon, which was written in Alexandria around 30 AD. "For she is the breath of the power of God, and a pure effluence from the glory of the Almighty. She is the brightness of the everlasting light, the unspotted mirror of the power of God, and the image of his goodness. And being but one, she can do all things, remaining in herself, she maketh all things new. And in all ages, entering into holy souls, she maketh them friends of God and prophets. For God loveth him that dwelleth with Sophia. For she is more beautiful than the sun, and above all the order of the stars. Being compared with the light, she is found before it. He that loveth her loveth life, and they that seek her early shall be filled with joy. He that holdeth her fast shall inherit glory, and wheresoever she entereth, the Lord will bless. They that serve her shall minister to the Holy One, and them that love her, the Lord doth love." The Wisdom of Solomon. Philo, and the author of Wisdom of Solomon, offer textual evidence of this myth, this story of Sophia, at a critical stage of its formation. But these are only really temporal snapshots of Sophia's myth within a broader cultural context and an extended organic development. In the first and second century of the new Christian age, Sophia's story was still undergoing a radical anamnesis, remembering, and development. The mythopoetic and religion-making imagination of the age was moving Sophia toward the center stage in the tale of a new numinous drama. And it was a radical transformation of the God image of that time. The myth of the Sophia and the Demiurge are key mythologems central to every summary of Gnosticism and that age. Okay, so Gnosis as mythology. But before I talk about the Gnostic myth of Sophia, which I'm going to, let's consider how Jung read such material. And he was reading it. He knew this myth very well. It was present in Gnostic texts that were in his library in 1915. He studied the symbolic content of the Gnosis for at least 15 years before he started working with alchemy. It is seldom recognized that Jung's reading of alchemy developed organically from his prior study of Gnosticism. It was a continuous study. He described alchemy as the bridge back to the foundations of Gnosticism. And we know a lot about his hermeneutics of alchemy. So, what was Jung's hermeneutics, his interpretive approach to motifs in Gnostic myth? Carl Carigne states in Essays on the Science of Mythology, and this is a work of two essays published in conjunction with Dr. Jung in 1941. Carigne states that, quote, "The Gnostics can tell us about what comes closest to mythology in mysticism," end quote. Academic discussions of Gnosticism usually allow the possibility of something termed a mystical experience in Gnosis, but it is treated by most modern commentaries as a Pandora's box, a box that cannot or should not be opened. The contents, by nature of their subjectivity, must remain an unexamined and peripheral domain. And while attributing classical descriptions of Sophia to a mystical experience, the experience itself is not the center of attention. Does that seem a bit strange? Jung spent decades trying to move this discussion forward, to examine the experience within or underlying myth and the formation of mythic texts. He suggested that there was a human imaginative or mystical experience, and you can choose your terms, and that the deepest fact of this experience could be conveyed sometimes only by story or myth or symbol. Among all the world's myths, there are a few primary myths, motifs that mirror the deepest archetypal patterns of underlying consciousness, images that stride like gods, circling at the horizon of time and human consciousness. Carigne suggested that the myth of Gnosis contained one of these primary forms. And Jung treated the story of Sophia and the Demiurge as primary mythologems, what in the hermeneutic language of his psychology can be called truly, really great archetypes. And at this Ionial Kairos, this point of transformation in the God image over 2,000 years ago, these archetypes transform, they burst anew from the egg of time and into human imagination. And that is very much the story Jung is telling in Ion. Jung suggested these great myths were living us, whether we like it or not, or whether we become conscious of it or not. Confronted consciously, an encounter with these primary myths might even open a doorway of imaginative meaning to us, for us, and they can become a framework for its constructive, synthetic, hermeneutic assimilation, the assimilation of contents coming forward from the unconscious, emerging from the unconscious. And Jung used all those words back in 1916 in his initial effort to explain what he was doing. Constructive, synthetic, hermeneutic approach to vision, to dream, symbol. And something like that seems to have occurred in Jung's experience around 1916, when a Gnostic vocabulary of assimilation or symbolic expression enters into his own primary record of Liber Novus, the primary hermeneutics, interpretive work of his visions. And after Liber Novus, Jung identified mythopoetic imagination as a doorway to the boundless realm. But let's ask an interpretive question. Is conscious immersion in that creative imagination properly described as a mystical experience? Is Liber Novus the product of a mystical experience? Can the term mysticism include an experience of dreaming the primordial dream? Meeting the story, emerging as a shoot from the universal root, from the primal root of the unconscious. Dr. Marvin Mayer recently and authoritatively defined gnosis as a mystical experience formed to mythic expression in a variety of dialects. 60 years earlier, in concert with Dr. Jung, Carl Carigne suggested the same. Gnostic mysticism generated a mythology. Its mythology is an expression of experience of the subjective factor. The Gnostic myths are an interpretation of vision. They transmute it, form it to myth. Myth was, at least so it seemed, the only possible expression of the voices and names and symbols arising from Gnostic experience of the depths. Myth and symbol are the crystallizations of their revelation. Now, Jung had met archetypal images and relationships, intimating timeless and unbounded archetypal realms underlying consciousness. They approached him through protein images. The images were experienced in relationship with each other and with a human story, yet being told. This was Jung's key to his reading of the Gnosis anciently and forward into our own time. Jung saw his experiences reflected in Gnostic myths, and he definitely saw them reflected in this primal, this key Gnostic myth of Sophia and the Demiurge. And we talked a bit about the Demiurge part of it last night. These myths provide a vocabulary to his experience, came to provide a vocabulary to his experience by 1916 in Liber Novus. So, the myth of Sophia. Sophia in Gnostic myth. You know, the Gnostic story of Sophia begins with nothing. Before time and space, before anything that might be called a before or after, there was a pleroma. It was fullness and emptiness. And it was entirely unapproachable by our differentiating consciousness. In the Seven Sermons to the Dead, Jung, or Basilides, or Philemon, or Simon Magus, it gets a little hard assigning the voice that spoke the seven sermons, because all of those voices are admixed up in Jung's telling of how this tale came to be told. Okay, in the Seven Sermons to the Dead, the voice speaking the sermons gives a good version of this Gnostic myth's beginning. It is entirely accurate to the tradition as we have it received textually. So let me just read you the beginning of the seven sermons. Hear ye, I begin with nothing. Nothing is the same as fullness. In the endless state, fullness is the same as emptiness. That which is endless and eternal has no qualities, because it has all qualities. The nothing or fullness is called by us the Pleroma. That's how the Seven Sermons to the Dead, which Jung wrote, or Basilides, or Simon Magus, or Philemon spoke in 1916. This indescribable Pleroma was the beginning. And then came a move towards differentiation. The sleeping one awoke and opened its eye. Pronoia is the Greek term used, or forethought. The first primal archetype of thought awoke and saw her playing there before him. Awaiting relationship. She was epinoia, or insight. She was forethought's initial relationship with his own expression. An insight equal in her depth to his breadth. This first pair, this is the Gnostic myth, this first pair, this first syzygy, rests ultimately beyond the threshold of, again, conscious comprehension. But in progressive stages of differentiation, the Gnostic myth tells about a pair that descends through a series of emanations, is the word, or images that can be constellated in human imagination. So through these progressive emanations, there came forward what the Gnostics called aeons. And the aeons are, I think, very much equivalent to what Jung called archetypes, the primordial images. So Gnostic myths tell the details of this emanational process in a variety of ways. How did it happen? How did these various manifestations come into formation? Many ancient imaginative voices apparently found this entire theme meaningful, and it was embellished differently within different textual traditions of the Gnosis. And Gnostic myths give variable accounts of Sophia's prologue in heaven, the time before time. This is one of them. From a series of pairs or syzygies, or increasingly differentiated dualities, eventually they're constellated a pair called Sophia, feminine, and Logos, masculine. Sophia was overcome by a power of love, and she desired union with the first source of all. She was on the edge of this vast realm of the fullness, and she looked out into the void. And saw a light glimmering. And she thought it was he. She thought it was the great source. But in fact, it was only a reflection of his glory in the vacant mirror of possibility. Seeking after him, seeing him as a projection upon the formless, she leapt toward it and fell into the depths. She fell into the empty embrace of her vision. She fell into the depths of vision. This story is told in a variety of ways. This is called the fall of Sophia. So what's that story say? I mean, you know, we've heard these myths of, you know, like you'll hear the myth in Jungian context of amor and psyche. How many times will you hear that in Jungian? You'll hear it quite a few times in Jungian discussions. Here, this is an incredible myth about how things are. So Sophia has now fallen into the depths, out of the supernal realm, and is apart from her proper twin, Syzygy, the Logos, who's up there in the supernal realm somewhere. So now outside these supernal realms, lost and captive in the void of the depths, Sophia experiences every psychic storm and emotion imaginable. And these condense into the elements of the cosmos. From her, there's separated also a being of incredible power. Something like an abortive, monstrous child came from her. And this fiery god was filled with pride and will and power. Jung called him Abraxas. In classical Gnostic myths, this demiurge has several names, among them Yaldabaoth and Soklus. So, Yaldabaoth, or Abraxas, or Soklus, marshaled a host of creative forces and built a world, and declared himself its master. He called himself the god of the world, the god above all gods, the one and only God. Sophia, looking at the flawed and troubled domain fashioned by this malefic and incomplete progeny, this abortion that had come from her, felt compassion. And she resolved to aid those that were in the captivity of the demiurge, of Abraxas, Yaldabaoth, Soklus, the names vary. She is the one who breathed the spirit of true life into humankind. And she helps them find liberation from the fiery rule of the false lord Abraxas. She was the spirit of life, the anima mundi, dwelling within sonic darkness and time. Her twin archetype, the male portion of this, a figure combined mythically with the Logos and with the name of Jesus, was still in the aeonial realm, separated from Sophia. It was his task to somehow return her from this exile in the depths, to find her and liberate her. When the Kairos arrived, he took the form of a human man and entered into this world. He was her true Syzygy. He was not an illusion. He wasn't the projection. He was the real thing. And this Jesus Christ, as he is sometimes called, took upon himself all forms of human suffering in order to find Sophia, join with her, and return with her to the aeonial realm.
That's new.
It's very old, actually. Very, very old.
Especially for a Catholic. This is quite new.
Well, It was actually very old, but the problem was is that there were Orthodox voices in the formation of, you know, the church around the second century that thought this was dangerous heresy. And that's why these texts were destroyed. But you know, before they got destroyed, around 180, 190, 200 AD, the people that were saying, because these texts were around, they started writing commentaries about these texts saying this is heresy, and they described this myth. This exact myth got described by Irenaeus and other Hippolytus and other of the heresiologists, and they said that, and the Gnostics say this, 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 and this, and they're absolutely wrong. So we have some of that record, right? But now we have actually, when the Nag Hammadi library came along, we found the original texts that the heresy fighters of the second and third century were talking about. So, and we see that as they told the story, it was distorted. The way they told it sometimes was pretty accurate. But, you know, always it was turned a little bit because they were arguing against it. Yes?
Basically territorial. I mean, wasn't Irenaeus part of an established new church who said that, oh, you must come to us, the bishop, to get contact with God? We don't like you to pass this on directly.
You know,
we want to.
There are.
Established church.
No, there was not. And let me just, I'll give you the one evidence of that particular situation. Valentinus was one of the, this myth is really related also to the Valentinian tradition. Valentinus, a well-documented historical figure, one of the primary voices of Gnosticism in Rome, okay? In the year 150 A.D., about 35 years before Irenaeus was writing his attacks on Valentinus, was considered for election as Bishop of Rome. That's also known today as the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
In 150 AD, Valentinus was prominent enough in the Christian community and considered himself part of the body of the church. He thought he was part of the body. He didn't see himself as a sectarian, as a cultist. He saw himself as a Christian. And he felt that the body had, you know, the body of Christ had many parts. And some people needed to hear this, and some people needed to keep it simpler. And then 30, 35 years later, Irenaeus is actually writing against Valentinus and his descendants. There are several historical figures that followed along in his line. And now in the Nag Hammadi library, we have several texts identified as directly from the lineage of Valentinus. One of them is the Gospel of Truth, which was in Codex 1, the Jung Codex. And it was that Gospel of Truth that Hiles Quispel was sitting out in Bollingen reading Jung in 1955 while Jung was pounding the table and saying, this is the original experience. Am I putting this together for you? It's a complicated history. This stuff has a history, and it's woven into the history of Christianity. The point is that Dr. Jung was finding in this myth, back then, a living experience of primordial depth. Not dogma. He was finding evidence of an experience. In another hermeneutic vocabulary, another vocabulary of myth, developed 1,000 years later, in the Grail legends, in the myths of the Middle Ages, one might describe the figure seeking Sophia as a knight elected to the service of a king and a lady and a grievous wound. You see, the myth goes through a long series of visionary recurrences. It's a different format, a different language, a different time. But one wonders, is this the same sort of archetypal formation coming forward? But at that moment of her redemption, when the Logos came into the world to find Sophia and unify with her, Sophia realized that she could not abandon the cosmos. She couldn't ascend and leave it. She was still needed. So what did she do? She divided into two. And one ascended like a dove. And one descended into cosmos, into matter, like a serpent, and dwells within it. A bringer of wisdom from within matter itself. Can you see elements there of an alchemical myth?
the whole Red Book.
Yeah. Serpent and dove. That's what happens with Jung's soul, right? That is in the Red Book. Jung knew this myth. Okay. So, in this dual image, this split, she becomes both like the Christian Holy Spirit, a dove ascending, and at the same time remains a comforter and a revelatory power, arising like a serpent from the depths of the cosmos, from the depths of earth, from the depths of the tissue of life. In this Gnostic myth of Sophia, Christ does not redeem humankind from sin and death and the moldering grave. He comes to release Sophia from ignorance, blindness, and her bondage in cosmic exile. And that is, one might notice, a theme that plays also in the alchemical myth. All right. Simon and Helen. Simon and Helen. Last night I introduced the Gnostic story of Simon Magus. By 1917, Jung had identified Philemon with this ancient Simon. It was part of his developing myth, the story he was hearing. And Jung had read the Gnostic tales of Simon by that date. He pondered this relationship between Philemon and Simon Magus. There probably was an historical figure living in the first century, in apostolic times, named Simon and called the Magus. At least someone is source of his many legends. In the late second century, there still existed writings that were attributed to his authorship, or to someone writing in his name. And these are quoted at length by Hippolytus at the end of the second and beginning of the third century, and more briefly by several other of the fighters of heresy. Based on this textual material and other apocryphal legends, second century churchmen communally judged that Simon Magus was the first great Gnostic heretic. He was the father of heretics, of Gnosticism. Temporally, Simon's revelation probably took form during the same period that the Gnostic myth of Sophia was developing. These are different mythic motifs now, you see. We're not talking about a single, I don't know, myth-making machine, you know, like you know, there's a Vatican where like myths come spinning out the front door. They're human beings all over this Oriental period, around the Mediterranean, are having these experiences. The ones who are calling themselves Gnostics are trying to actually see what the hell is going on. They're trying to feel something coming up, and the only way they can express it in this mythic formation, and a variety of myths and people come. So, Simon Magus was one. Temporally, he probably did live in apostolic times. The role of Sophia in Simon's myth is also given to a feminine figure. But she's not called Sophia by Simon, she's called Thought. She was the first fact seen in the effulgence of primal light. She is the first image met by the archetypal potential named Forethought. Forethought confronts her as his initial thought. She's the first image met by the archetypal potential named Forethought, the thing before thought. And this primary pair, this masculine-feminine syzygy again, this duality, forms at the beginning. In Simon's myth, this feminine power, like Sophia, descends into the cosmos and was indwelling in creation, in earth, in flesh. Simon knows himself as the one sent to find her, this feminine that's been exiled. And Simon takes on the role of the Logos in this rendition of the Sophianic tale. Rather, he sort of plays the role of the Christ figure, the Jesus figure. He is the mortal man upon whom the Logos has descended. It's his task to rescue her, his primal syzygy, from a realm that does not recognize her presence. So Simon's myth is a peculiar mirror image of the Christ story. In Simon's myth, the redemptive act occurs not through Simon's death by crucifixion, but through his announcement of the feminine divine image indwelling the world. She, the feminine twin aeon of the Logos, is the one hanging on the cross, the four-formed cross of matter. Simon, in the role of a redeemer, recognizes her. He historically meets her in a woman named Helen, or Helena. Now, Simon meets Helen, or Helena, in a back alley of the port city of Tyre, where at the moment she happens to be a prostitute working in a whorehouse. So say his opponents. But Helen, at this moment, though appearing the most debased of things, a thing of no worldly honor, Simon recognizes as his primal bride, as the image of Sophia. So, in the broader mythic vocabulary of the age, this feminine image, and she's not always named Sophia, is the great light on the cross of matter. She is the mystery indwelling fleshly life. She is the supernal mother of life. Jung uses the term anima mundi frequently. The Latin word means world soul. Sophia in Gnostic myths is this anima mundi. She is the essential prima materia, imaged and sought by later alchemical tradition. She is hidden somewhere in the slag, in the dross, and yet she is the treasure buried in the field. She's everywhere, and yet she is seldom seen. Okay? So, it's difficult to say, based on the textual tradition, exactly how Simon saw the fact of the incarnation of a feminine ion, a feminine archetype, in this woman. Was she really the woman Helen? Or was Helen simply a place where she dwelt or through whom he met her? And these are the same sorts of questions that actually circled at this time and for 1,000 years thereafter about the incarnation of the Logos in Jesus of Nazareth. How did a God get mixed up with a man? Well, how did the Logos's female syzygy get mixed up with a woman? Can you see how this idea, these myths, might have played upon Jung's imagination, how they might have been mixed up in his understanding of anima and animus? And of men and women and their relationships. But you see, that's part of his later hermeneutics. So, Dr. Jung identified Zosimos as the alchemist who historically linked Gnosticism with the alchemical tradition. And look, if you're going to study Jung, you're going to figure out that alchemy was pretty important to him from 1930 on, and that he considered alchemy to be a continuation of Gnosticism, and he saw alchemy as connected historically to Gnosticism, okay? And he said Zosimos was the historical figure who was the connecting link. That was his feeling. The lineages connecting Zosimos and Gnosticism remain historically quite obscure. But if it is so, if Jung was right, if alchemy does have an historical relationship with Gnosticism, during this period, 3rd century or so, the tradition of Simon Magus, the first named Gnostic, and archetypal worker of the great work, was probably a lineage of Gnosticism that was known by this Zosimos. I should add that Zosimos' teacher was known as Maria the Prophetess. Maria the Prophetess was Zosimos' teacher. She's also known in the alchemical texts as Maria the Jewess. You'll run into her in Jung's alchemical writings, I assure you. Okay, Mary of Magdala in Gnostic myth. Of course, this image of syzygies in relationship, of genders in relationship, if we use a physical metaphor of duality, are manifest in the Jesus tradition as well. In Gnostic texts, Jesus has many prominent female companions. A woman named Salome is among them. Though what mythic connection she had to the Salome who danced for the head of John the Baptist is never made clear. Jung had read Salome's story in the Gnostic text Pistis Sophia, where Salome stands frequently beside Mary of Magdala. And in the Gnostic text, particularly in Pistis Sophia, she has a very strong voice. And Jung may have formed imaginative images of her story between the time she danced for the head of John the Baptist and stood beside Mary of Magdala by the Master's side. But that's just my conjecture. But the principal disciple beside Jesus in most Gnostic myths is Mary of Magdala. Among all the stories emerging from the Gnostic Gospels, this is the one that at this moment in history seems to have aroused an incredible libido in the collective psyche. So, did Jesus have a wife? Or a girlfriend? In the Gnostic Gospel of Philip, found at Nag Hammadi, we have this enticing image of a relationship with Mary of Magdala. And it starts with the invocation of Sophia's name. This is the text from the Gospel of Philip found at Nag Hammadi. It starts with an invocation of Sophia's name. Listen to this. Sophia, who is called barren, is the mother of the angels. Sophia, who is called barren, gives nothing, has no produce, has no child. She is the mother of the angels, angelos. Angelos means a messenger, right? She is the mother of the messengers. And then the text continues. The companion of the Savior is Mary of Magdala. The Savior loved her more than all the other disciples, and he kissed her often on her mouth. The other disciples said to him, "Why do you love her more than all of us?" The Savior answered and said to them, "Why do I not love you like her?" If a blind person and one who can see are both in darkness, they are the same. When the light comes, one who can see will see the light, and the blind person will stay in darkness. End of quote. So the myth told by the Gnostics do not identify Mary of Magdala as a girlfriend or as a wife of Jesus of Nazareth in any colloquial sense that we understand. They say Mary of Magdala was a chief disciple and companion, and Jesus kissed her often on the mouth. Actually, it doesn't say that. It does not say mouth. It says in the sole existing Coptic manuscript of the Gospel of Philip, he kissed her often on her blank. Because this manuscript right there, there's a hole in the manuscript. That word is lost. It's called a lacuna in the manuscript. The parchment chipped away. So it says, and Jesus kissed her often on her blank. So it could have been, it could have been something else. It could have. But, ladies and gentlemen, mouth seems appropriate in this hermeneutic context.
Forehead.
It could have been that too. But you see that this is it. This it's sort of a synchronous Gnostic joke, right? That in a weird, paradoxical, Jungian fashion, it's a statement about how our culture interprets things. This mysterious Mary, who was a disciple of the Master, by fact of a missing word, can be turned into an image of human sexual relationship.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that... And what part of the relationship are people really interested in?
Sex.
Yeah.
In the world of so-called pariahs.
Yeah. So, this relationship exposed in that text, when contextualized with other surrounding material, implies that Mary Magdalene was both a symbolic and a real figure in the story of Jesus. She was the Apostola Apostolorum, the apostle to the apostles, in the Christian tradition. She was the messenger to the other apostles. In Gnostic exegesis, her story was true, even when it became fictive. Fictive, imaginal elements of the story were Gnostic facts. Stories were sometimes true. This is mythologizing mysticism, as Carinier called it. It grants reality both to story and to history. Inner and outer facts wed. Simon and Helen are a variation, a transmutation of this image of Christ and Magdalene. And at the beginning of the Christian age, both of these stories, Simon's story and Jesus' story and Mary of Magdala's story and Helen's story, they were all playing together within Gnostic imagination, just as they played outwardly on the stage of history. The bridal chamber mystery in the Gospel of Philip. So, there's another theme in the Gospel of Philip that requires comment. And Dr. Jung never saw the Gospel of Philip. This was not available to him during his life. And this theme is the mystery of the bridal chamber, as it's called. Some scholars suggest, all of the Gospel of Philip, found at Nag Hammadi, is a commentary on this ultimate mystery of the Valentinian Gnostic tradition. I mentioned Valentinus earlier. This text is attributed to his tradition. In Philip, it is stated that the Master offered 5 symbolic or sacramental mysteries. And here's the key text from the Gospel of Philip. And I quote, "The Master did everything in a mystery. Baptism, chrism, Eucharist, redemption, and bride chamber." Now, Orthodox tradition retained clearly the first 3 of these rituals. Baptism is rebirth in water. Chrism, or confirmation, is the anointing with the fire of the Holy Spirit. The Eucharist is the symbolic sacrifice and union of bread and water and wine. But these last 2 mysteries, mentioned in the Gospel of Philip, a text dating back to the 2nd century, remain just that. They're mysteries. It has been conjectured that the mystery of redemption was liberation that Gnosis provided from bondage to the Demiurge, the spirit of the time, the ruler of the world. And that seems plausible. It's conjecture, but it's plausible. But the bridal chamber mystery was the final mystery, and it remains so. But it does seem to have been an experience. Let me read a few sections from the Gospel of Philip that comment on this event called the mystery of the bridal chamber. And I read, "The separation of male and female was the beginning of death. Christ came to heal the separation that was from the beginning and reunite the two, in order to give life to those who died through separation and unite them. Another text from Philip. And this section begins with a bold proclamation. It says, "It is necessary to declare a mystery." And then this text follows. "The Father of all united with the Virgin who came down, and fire shone on him. On that day, that one revealed the great bridal chamber. On that day, he came forth from the bridal chamber as one born of a bridegroom and a bride. So Jesus established all within it." Then I'll just read you these last concluding words from the Gospel of Philip. Once again, this text, like all of these texts I'm reading, this is available on my internet page. If you want to go looking for it, it's available in numerous texts, academic texts, including the full text of the Nag Hammadi Library. But if you just look Gospel of Philip on the internet, you'll go right to my page. It'll be the first thing you find. Okay? So these are the concluding words of the Gospel of Philip. "If one becomes an attendant of the bridal chamber, that one will receive the light. Those who receive the light cannot be seen or grasped. Nothing can trouble such people, even while they are living in this world. And when they leave this world, they have already received truth through images." They have already received truth through images. "And the world has become an eternal realm. To these people, the eternal realm is fullness. This is the way it is. It is revealed to such a person alone, hidden not in darkness and night, but hidden in perfect day and holy light." And that's how the Gospel of Philip ends. So in Gnostic tradition, this final mystery appears to be a type of hieros gamos, a holy wedding, a mysterium conjunctionis, the mystery of a bridal chamber. And look, there are a lot of people playing with this text. I think this really has to do with some sort of like sexual mystery, or, you know, that's our culture. When you read this stuff, that's not what's going on here. That is simply not what's going on here. Of course, a lot of the opponents of Gnosis said this was all libertine sexuality. And of course, you know, look, sex gets mixed up in deep... Our sexuality and relationship issues get mixed up when we start dealing with these sorts of archetypal issues. And it can lead to some real disasters in therapeutic relationships, in human relationships. So yes, it gets mixed up, but it's not just on the outside. Okay. The images of Philemon and Sapientia. Okay, folks, pull out those big red books again. And turn imaginatively to page 154 and 155. Folio 154 and 155. The book opens before you. And I could have shown this on a screen, but just go look at the book. Forget the damn electronic stuff. Here's the book. It's open. This is page 154. This is page 155. On this page here, there's a picture of Philemon we talked about last night.
Yes.
Book opens. What's on the page facing him? What's on that page?
Something about problems.
The image is on page 154 of Philemon, and the image on the facing page, 155, is titled Sapientia, which is the Latin term for Sophia, wisdom. These were painted by Dr. Jung in 1924. They are a thematic conclusion to the Red Book's transcription, and they are a summary moment in Jung's experience of his material, of his experience. After completing these two images, transcription of his drafts into the big red leather folio crawled to a close. Dr. Shamdasani notes that it was around this time that Jung's conversations with his soul also ended in the black books, 1923 to 24. After these two paintings, the next image in the red book occurs 3 years later, and it's on page 159. So he only went 4 pages in 3 years thereafter, transcribing. And then in 1928, there's the image of the Golden Castle, and then on page 160, that's on 163. And then the very last image and text that Jung transcribed was on page 169 of the Red Book, and that was probably around 1930. Later, in the late 50s, he felt he needed to finish his book. And the old man went back, and after about page 169, if you look at the handwriting, you'll see it gets a little bit shakier, and it's not completed, and he didn't finish in the coloring. Sometime very near the end of his life, he said, I've just got to finish this. And he got the manuscripts out, and he started writing in the Red Book again. And then he finally gets, I think, to page 189. It ends in mid-sentence. He turns the page and he puts in his last note in his own handwriting. You know, I started this work, so and so and so and so. And then his note about the Red Book ends in mid-sentence too. I think the last word on the page is possibility. And then the sentence ends. That's how the Red Book ends. Okay? All right. So these pictures really are a thematic conclusion in Dr. Jung's experience. And after these pictures are done, he in a way is done. Philemon and Sophia, Sapientia. There they are, on the pages before you. At the top of Jung's picture of Philemon, we discussed the inscriptions last time. What did he write around Sophia? At the top of Jung's image of Sophia, he scribed these words, and they are from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. For those of you who don't know the Bible, that's in the New Testament. Dei sapientia in mysterio. The wisdom of God in a mystery. Even hidden wisdom, which God ordained before the world unto our glory. The Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. That is the inscription in Latin, beginning with Dei Sapientia in Mysterio, around the picture of Sapientia, wisdom. On either side of the arch is the following, and by the way, these translations are in your red book. Dr. Shamdasani has them there. They're in the footnotes if you look. On either side of the arch is the following inscription, and this is taken from the Revelation of John, chapter 22, verse 17. Spiritus et sponsa dicunt, vene, et qui audit dicat, vene. The Spirit and the Bride say, come. The Spirit and the Bride say, come. Let him who heareth say, come. And let him that is athirst come. And whoever will, let him take the water of life freely. And above the arch is the inscription, Ave Virgo Virginum. Praise, hail, Virgin of Virgins. So, we talked about Philemon yesterday. Lady Sophia. And is it Philemon and Sapientia there on the page? Or is it Simon and Helen? Or Elijah and Salome? Logos and Sophia? Or perhaps a prophet and a bride? Because, well, in the tradition of Simon, of which Philemon apparently belonged, the prophet did have a bride. The prophet had a bride in Simon's tradition. Together, these images pointed Dr. Jung toward the mystery of a sacred wedding. He was paying attention. He was trying to understand. This is the focus of a circumambulating study as he moved toward the Mysterium Conjunctionis. I have heard people describe this picture of sapientia as Jung's soul, or anima. And, of course, at one point, Jung's soul did speak to him on January 16, 1916, in a Sophianic voice. And, in fact, in the Nag Hammadi scriptures, we have a text called the Exegesis of the Soul, in which the soul, by that name, tells the entire story of Sophia. She, the soul, takes on the role of Sophia and tells this entire Sophianic myth that I've told you earlier today. But in Jung's image of Sophia, in sapientia, in Latin, he really is pointing deeper. Jung has struggled with this paradoxical soul in the Red Book, and you encounter that. Near the end of Liber Novus, he repeats his frequent question, "Are you lying again? Damned, tormenting spirit, deceiving fiend, what are your treacherous specters supposed to mean?" When Jung was painting that picture in 1924, his conversation with that spirit, deceiving fiend, came to an end. That was the end of it in the Black Books. This primordial feminine image is part of the universal root of Jung's experience. Perhaps I should use Dr. Jung's psychological vocabulary and describe her as an archetypal dominant underlying the imaginal feminine he had met. She is the summation experience of many spectral manifestations. She is the unity and totality of a relationship with a fact indwelling in the depths of humankind. She is epinoia, or the insight granted through relationship with the infinity that mysteriously indwells both cosmos and consciousness. And he announces her name, Wisdom. History, story, and myth. In the study of Dr. Jung, we're forced to follow three separate threads: a historical record full of documentary facts and writings, a story about the man, which is interpretive of facts and rumors, and richly combined with intuitions and recollection and lies. And we have a myth. For many years, we have had only hints of the myth. Now we have Liber Novus, the living fact of Jung's myth. All these threads of history, story, and myth are so complexly woven together. It's hard to tease them apart. And perhaps that is what happens if one lives a symbolic life. But then, symbolic lives are rare things, so it's hard to judge. But underlying all of this, understand, I am here talking about Jung's myth. What is the experience behind his hermeneutic expression of his mythopoetic vision? What is the root? On the left hand, we had Father of the Prophets, the Returning One. He is Elijah, Philemon, Krishna. In a voice, he said to Jung, "My daughter and my wisdom are one." And on the right, we have sapientia, wisdom, Sophia, daughter of the Great Father. It is she, Sophia, who makes men friends of God and prophets. Two images: a father of the prophets and a bride. This is part of Jung's myth, the story telling him. And he had to understand it. As Carrie Baines wrote in that quote I read from last night, Jung said he could not identify with Philemon. He could not identify with this master. He had to understand the process. C.G. Jung's second great hermeneutic task was understanding, interpreting this process. So what would have happened if Jung would have identified with the master? I suppose he would have bubbled out into a big balloon and declared himself a prophet in 1916 to absolutely no good end. And, you know, there are people who want to declare him as a prophet today. I'm not one of them. I call him Dr. Jung, right? Because he was trying to understand this process. But there was a process. Such stuff happened. It was part of the imaginal process forming a religion and a heresy 2,000 years ago. And yes, there were people who did identify. I mean, obviously Simon Magus, he identified with the master. He declared himself the Logos seeking, and he thought that woman really was, by history's view, she really was. Sophia. The story and the life cross. But then we have that also in the Jesus tradition, don't we? A story and a life crossing on a cross. These things mix and match in human history. Okay. Stepping into a hole backwards. Dr. Jung started his work on Mysterium Conjunctionis around 1942. Sonusham Dasani provides a picture, actually, of the first initial manuscript page of Dr. Jung's manuscript in the book C.G. Jung, A Biography in Books. And if any of you are really interested in Jung stuff, if you really should own this book. It is incredibly beautiful. Sham Dasani really takes you right into Jung's library, goes through all of his manuscript stuff, all the books he was reading, the stuff I've been talking to you about. It's an amazing book. They have it in the library for sale here, and I'm sure they have a copy that you can look at. Just look at it, at least. But the text that Dr. Sham Dasani puts in that book is brilliant. He really goes through and lays out the story. It's the first biography of Jung to really incorporate Liber Novus into the story, the first one that really accurately does. Okay. And Sham Dasani notes that that manuscript page, titled by Jung Mysterium Conjunctionis, actually is the beginning text of Psychology of the Transference. And that was Jung's first reading of the Rosarium Philosophorum. Do you guys know the Psychology of the Transference, the commentary? You know those little pictures and sort of those sexy pictures in the...
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, you've run across that, okay.
You have to remind me a lot when you were talking about the Gospel of Philip.
Yeah. 3 hours ago, I was sitting in Jung's library holding his copy of the Rosarium, looking at the passages he had underlined. His original copy, that it was the first alchemical book he bought, and Andreas let me go through it this afternoon. And looking at the passages he had underlined in the Rosarium, that he was reading that text in 1930. He had thought about this text for 14 years, or 12 years at least, when he started writing Mysterium Conjunctionis. And the first part of what was going to be Mysterium Conjunctionis was his commentary on the Rosarium. That was the beginning of Mysterium Conjunctionis. It was his interpretation of the anima, animus, relationship, and the transference, all keyed to symbolic images of the alchemical wedding in the Rosarium Philosophorum. Then Dr. Jung stepped backwards into a hole in his own garden. Or at least that is how he saw it, and that's how he told the story. as he expressed it, he had thought there was something wrong in his attitude as he was writing that Psychology of the Transference. Something was missing in his hermeneutics, his psychological language of approaching his text. And he felt that he had stepped backwards into his own hole. That's exactly what he said. The facts are that he took a walk this week, 69 years ago, slipped on the ice, understandable out there today, broke his ankle, had a blood clot, had a pulmonary embolus, and nearly died. And he hung between life and death for about 3 weeks. And during this critical period of illness, Jung had a series of visions. Barbara Hanna described them, as I said before, as Jung's second initiation. Beginning in 1913, at the age of 38, Jung had consciously engaged an inner mythic reality. The activity continued for years. This was his first initiation, to use Barbara Hanna's expression. For 30 years, he followed the implications of this experience. At the very, very beginning of his journey, Jung most closely associated his experience with Gnosticism. He identified his master Philemon, met in vision as an Alexandrian Gnostic. Philemon subsequently disclosed himself as Simon Magus, whose bride Helena was the incarnation of Sophianic wisdom. Jung pondered this story. The myth led him on, wandering through the visionary traditions of the West, searching experiential evidence for a story he knew was not his alone. Jung eventually determined that he had identified its roots reaching across centuries, manifest in Gnosticism, Hermeticism, alchemy, medieval heretical traditions, and Jewish Kabbalah. He recognized the unifying fact of a central and defining experience hidden somewhere within all of these traditions. It was the imaginative, mythopoetic imagination, initiation he had in measure shared. And that is quite clearly Jung's reading of things. Jung's exploration led him inexorably toward an experience he perceived as having been witnessed by this history, the Mysterium Conjunctionis. Historically, it had been symbolized in the holy wedding of two natures, named with many names, divine and human, male and female. Sense and nonsense, inner and outer, above and below. King and queen, Eros, Logos, heaven, earth. During the years immediately prior to 1944, Jung was grappling with alchemical and Kabbalistic texts at that time too, ciphering cryptic textual evidence about this experience, which he perceived as central to a tradition. It was the focus of a work he had started writing, a work he conceived might be his opus magnum, and it was titled Mysterium Conjunctionis, the mystery of the conjunction. And now, during his illness in 1944, in February of 1944, 69 years ago, it happened to him. He says, "The visions and experiences were utterly real. There was nothing subjective about them." Many of you know this story. It is in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. In the first vision, he found himself in the mystical Kabbalistic, Jewish Kabbalistic wedding of Tifereth and Malkuth. And I should explain for those who don't know Jewish Kabbalistic symbolism, Malkuth was the cosmos, the earth center of this mystical tree. And the thing that dwelt in Malkuth was the Shekinah, the feminine presence of the divine indwelling. So he found himself in the wedding of Tifereth and Malkuth, the above and the below, in this Kabbalistic mysticism. And he recounts, and here I quote, "I cannot tell you how wonderful it was. At bottom, it was I myself. I was the marriage." And my beatitude was that of a blissful wedding. Then followed the marriage of the Lamb in a Jerusalem, festively bedecked. I cannot describe what it was like in detail. There were ineffable states of joy. Angels were present, and light. I myself was the marriage of the Lamb. That too vanished, and there came a new image, the last vision. I walked up a wide valley to the end, where a gentle chain of hills began. The valley ended in a classical amphitheater. It was magnificently situated in the green landscape, and there, in this theater, the Hieros Gamos was being celebrated. The journey, end quote. The journey started in Liber Novus with Jung's petition to his soul, whom he found again only through the soul of a woman. That's what it says in the notes there. She had subsequently offered herself in the form of Salome as a bride. He had followed the trail of that elusive, mystical wedding across the ages. And now his story had reached an experiential conclusion. Jung had entered the bridal chamber. He had met the bride. I was the wedding. I was the marriage. Those were his words. He was not bridegroom, and he was not bride. Jung was an empiricist. Look, Jung repeatedly claimed he was an empiricist. He wasn't much into belief. He said, I could never have believed such an event was possible. But this, he said, was real. Jung had circumambulated this experience for 40 years in his readings, in his studies. And now he knew. Barbara Hanna says this event changed Dr. Jung. This event reoriented his work and his hermeneutics. Jung was an empiricist, and he sought witness for his subjective experiences in history. That is how one worked with the subjectivity of the psyche and built a scientific psychology. The prior hermeneutic expression of experience, the prior expression or formation of experience, was necessary evidence to his psychology. Where was the witness of an experience like that? In his last four great works, what I call his last quartet, published after 1944, Jung returned to enunciating the myth and message of Liber Novus. It was a witness of his experience. All four books of his last quartet circle one subject, the Mysterium Conuncionis. And those works are Psychology of the Transference, Ion, Answer to Job, and Mysterium Conuncionis. Job, the Demiurge, and Sophia. In an interview with Mircea Eliade in 1952, Jung talked about Answer to Job, the third movement of his final quartet. It erupted unbidden shortly after he had finished writing Ion. And Dr. Jung said to Eliade, quote, the book has always been on my mind, but I waited 40 years to write it. I discovered that Yahweh is unjust, that he is even an evil doer, end quote. Jung heard this signal story of classical Gnosticism, the ancient myth of a demiurge and Sophia, about 40 years before he spoke those words, as witnessed in the appendix to the Red Book. Dr. Shamdasani has called Answer to Job Jung's theology of Liber Novus. In it, Jung addresses both the demiurge and Sophia. Let me read from Answer to Job. In this passage, he warns of the burden resting upon our age and the dangers we collectively face in this disordered time. I quote, all the Christian virtues are needed and something else beside. For the problem is not only moral. We also need the Sophia that Job was seeking. But at that time, Job's time, she was still hidden from Yahweh, or rather, she was not yet remembered by him. The higher and complete man is begotten by the unknown Father and born from Sophia. And it is he who represents our totality, which transcends consciousness. End quote. The return of wisdom was central to Jung's vision. It was a story told by human vision across an aeon. He recognized the confirmation of his intuitions about her in Pope Pius XII's declaration of the dogma of the Assumption of the Virgin. Jung saw in this new proclamation that, quote, Mary as the bride is united with the Son in the heavenly bridal chamber, and as Sophia with the Godhead. In answer to Job, Jung remarks at length on the significance of this proclamation. Firstly, Jung says, and I quote, it is a symbolic fulfillment of John's vision. Secondly, it contains an allusion to the marriage of the Lamb at the end of time. And thirdly, it repeats the Old Testament anamnesis of Sophia, unforgetting, the remembering. A fulfillment of vision, a bridal chamber mystery, and an anamnesis, the remembering of Sophia. Jung historically placed the prior anamnesis of Sophia at the threshold of the anciently developing Christian aeon over 2,000 years ago. The papal dogma was a new chapter in her myth, in her story. The story was alive. Jung continues in answer to Job. It is psychologically significant for our day that in the year 1950, the heavenly bride was united with the bridegroom. In order to interpret this event, one has to consider the prefigurations in the apocalyptic marriage of the Lamb and in the Old Testament anamnesis, remembering of Sophia. The nuptial union in the bridal chamber signifies the hieros gamos, and this in turn is the first step towards incarnation, towards the birth of the Savior who, since antiquity, was thought of as the filius solis et lunae, the son of the sun and moon, the filius sapientia, the son of wisdom, and the equivalent of Christ. Although he is already born in the pleroma, his birth and time can only be accomplished when it is perceived, recognized, and declared by man. Dr. Jung is here reading a myth in history. And a powerful orienting symbol is emerging from the primordial root. He thought it crucial we give it our eye and our ear and our cautious, conscious understanding. Wisdom is needed in the coming centuries. We are at a crossroad in human consciousness, and the soul has things to say. A bridge across time. The image of a root. In these lectures, I've tried to offer new perspectives and a new interpretive voice on the subject of Jung and Gnosis, the tradition of Gnosis. Jung met and long considered its myths, and he gave a meaningful hermeneutics to the tradition. In the tradition of Gnosis, Jung found a primordial rhizome. By examining both Jung's myth of Gnosis and the hermeneutics he used in reading the tradition, we are given another piece of the puzzle of Dr. Carl Gustav Jung. It is part of the whole. Thank you.